insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back and we're going to get straight to the phones. If you'd like to be on the air, the number is 888-914-9149. Sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, 888-914-9149. Let us go now to Sarah in Chicago. Good morning, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me?
Now I can, yes. Welcome.
Okay, hi. So I had a question about sacramentals. How do you explain them to somebody who doesn't believe without sounding superstitious? Like, we wear the scapular as a devotion to the Blessed Mother, and in the promises, it's if you wear it, you won't go to hell. So how do you explain that to somebody without making it sound superstitious?
Okay, I would put it this way. Let's first of all stipulate, what is a sacramental? Unlike a sacrament, which gives sanctifying grace, a sacramental doesn't give grace, but it's a sign that helps to dispose your mind to be able to receive God's grace. So a crucifix, a rosary, lighting a candle, genuflecting, blessing yourself with holy water, receiving the blessing of a priest, the Bible, and on and on and on. These are all examples of sacramentals, and they are external. They don't give grace, but they make your mind and your heart more prepared to receive grace when the time comes. So if we want to use a natural analogy, Sarah, this might be helpful, would be to say, well, when you see the American flag, assuming that you're patriotic, doesn't it make you kind of smile inside? When you see the American flag, it reminds you of this great country in which we live, with all of its flaws, but it's still a great country. It reminds you of the heroism of those men and women who fought to keep us safe, etc. So this symbol that doesn't have any power unto itself, it has an effect on your mind and your emotions. Another example. So if we're looking at the flag, what about other symbols? Fireworks, for example, on the 4th of July. Well, the fireworks are not doing anything to you, to your soul or anything like that, but in the same way, it can stir a sense of civic pride. It can stir a sense of patriotism. We see the same things with statues. So like the statue of Abraham Lincoln sitting in his big chair in Washington, D.C. in the Lincoln Memorial. And you can have feelings that derive from seeing that, and that is a way that makes you feel either, well, hopefully anyway, more patriotic or grateful, whatever. Mm-hmm. So using natural examples like that may be helpful. A wedding ring is another example. A wedding ring, it tells you that she is off the market. A woman wearing a wedding ring means that she's not for you. She's for somebody else, but not for you. And there are certain symbols like a wedding ring or fireworks or the flag that in our mind, it disposes us in one direction or another. And the sacramentals do that, but they do it in a religious way.
So how would you say, like, somebody is like, well, what's the difference between wearing a scapular versus wearing some kind of crystal?
Well, the difference is that the Blessed Virgin Mary gave this as a sign to St. Simon Stock. And scapulars, of course, existed long before that. A scapular is just from the Latin word scapula, which means shoulders. And it's a cloth that's worn over the shoulders, usually long in the front and long in the back for religious sisters and others. But for lay people, to make it more, you know, comfortable and more practical, it's miniaturized. And she proposed that people wear this as a reminder to themselves and others of their trust in God and their love for the Blessed Virgin Mary as a special intercessor. And so it ends a way, since I mentioned wedding rings, let's go back to wedding rings. It's like a wedding ring. So if you're married and occasionally you glance down at your left hand and you see the wedding ring, it reminds you that you're married. It reminds you of your beloved. And it's also a sign publicly to others that you are committed to this man. And the scapular is the same kind of thing. Wearing the scapular, by the way, is not a guarantee of going to heaven. What it's a reminder of is that you have a special devotion to Our Lady and that you are trusting her, because she promised you would, to pray for you in a particular way, especially at the hour of your death, to help you to have all the graces necessary to go to heaven, to die in the state of friendship with Jesus. So it's like a wedding ring in that sense. It's a reminder to you and a reminder to people who might see you wear a scapular. Oh, she's Catholic. Oh, she has a devotion to Mary. Whether they agree with you or not, whether the guy who sees the woman with the wedding ring wishes that she weren't married is immaterial. He knows that she is. So that's the way a scapular functions. It's not magic. Mm-hmm. Some people presume that wearing a crystal will be like magic and it will ward off evil spirits, or it will, you know, have some power unto itself. And even the sacramentals don't really have that power. It's the power of God and what these sacramentals represent. Mm-hmm. And so it is a beautiful symbol of one's devotion to Our Lady. But wearing that scapular itself is not going to be a guarantee of salvation. You could have a scapular on the worst sinner in the world, and if he doesn't repent of his sins and believe in Jesus before he dies, he's not going to go to heaven, even if he wore 10 scapulars. Because it doesn't work that way. It's not a magic amulet or a good luck charm. Some people think it is, but it's not. You see?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Always happy to talk about these interesting topics. Let's go to Patrick now in Iowa. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. My question is it heretical to deny the divine attribute of simplicity, or is divine simplicity a de fide teaching of the Catholic Church?
Well, it would be certainly, it would be heretical, it would be sinful if you knowingly denied a de fide teaching of the Church, yes. But if you don't know that teaching, and I would venture to say that few people do understand that teaching, much less even know about it, that God is utterly simple as a pure spirit. He has no parts. He's not divided into parts. We could go on and on talking about that, but few people get into those metaphysical waters, so they don't know about that. So if somebody doesn't really know, he doesn't even know the Church teaches this, and he holds a view contrary to it, it's not intentional, it's not sinful, he's just uninformed. And maybe he'll live his whole life that way, because, you know, no one ever explains it to him. But once he does know, let's say he goes and gets a degree in philosophy at a Catholic university, and he takes a course on metaphysics, and he learns about this, and he realizes, oh, by the way, this is a de fide doctrine. Well, then with that knowledge comes a responsibility to assent to it. He may wonder about it. He may puzzle over it. He may think, I don't even understand how that can work. But that's not the same thing as dissenting from it. But if in his situation he were to dissent from it and say, I don't care if the Bible says this or the Church teaches this, I'm not going to believe it. Yeah, that would be a problem. But so few people on this topic would ever be in any danger of that.
You said that would be a problem. What do you mean by problem? In the case of the seminarian or someone like that who ought to know, would it be heretical to deny that doctrine?
Yeah, as I said at the very beginning, it would be heresy.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Do you have a particular case in mind, or are you just thinking out loud?
I do, but I don't want to talk about it here.
No problem. I totally understand it. Well, I'm glad we talked about that bit of it anyway. Thank you, Patrick. Let's go to Lonnie in Modesto. Good morning, Lonnie.
Good morning, Patrick. You know, I was going to call yesterday, but the conversation was about the talk with your kids, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to wait a day. I'll call tomorrow.
Okay.
My question was about Lucifer and St. Michael. Now, Lucifer, I know, was the greatest, God's greatest creation, like the top as far as angels go. So when he rebelled against God, St. Michael stood up and basically cast him out of heaven. Well, St. Michael, I've always wondered this, is part of the archangel choir, which is like the second from the bottom when it comes to the nine choirs. Wouldn't it have been necessary to have a seraphim angel, someone, you know, more equal with Lucifer to cast him out? I never quite understood that.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. So in with regard to the choirs of angels, you're absolutely right. The archangel choir is the second lowest in the nine choirs of angels.
Mm-hmm.
So two things that we can say. Number one is that the term archangel doesn't necessarily have to be restricted to just that. It also means great, like higher, greater. An archbishop is a greater office, a higher office. I mean, he's still a bishop. He's no different from any other bishop, but there's a higher status or authority, perhaps, as an archbishop, which is the same word as archangel. We just say it differently because the next letter begins with an A. So I would propose, number one, that it's in that second sense that we're referring to St. Michael the archangel. He may very well have been a seraphim. Or a seraph would be the singular. And we're just applying the term archangel to denote his high status. Now, that's one thing that we could, I think, reasonably say. The other thing is, it's entirely possible that God used a very lowly angel to thwart and subjugate the highest of all angels as part of his punishment. You know, that he, the highest of the seraphim, would be subdued and subjugated by a quote-unquote lowly archangel. It seems like that would be a fitting punishment for him and his pride to be brought low by an angel that would be, you know, in all other ways, inferior to him. So I could see that, right, too, as a possibility.
I have never thought of it that way, but that's a very good, that's a very good point. Yeah, okay. That helps answer that then. Good. I've always wondered about that.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I love the topic of angels. I can't get enough of it. And just think, Lonnie, one of these days when we get there, all the things we're going to learn about the angels face to face, it's going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, and what's amazing to me, because we are considered higher than the angels, are we not, in God's overall plan?
We are lower than the angels in God's overall plan. So in terms of his creation, the angels rank higher than human beings. The book of Hebrews talks about this a little bit in chapter 1, but we are lower in the created order than angels. They're more intelligent, more powerful than we are. In fact, by way of analogy, angels look after us in a way analogous to how we look after animals. Animals are lower than human beings in the created order, and yet they're higher than other lower orders of creation like plants and insects and things like that. So there's this sort of hierarchy in creation. Angels are above us, and even though it's not like the way we relate to animals per se, there is a similarity there. So they look after us. They sort of tend to our needs, those who are assigned to us. And I think thinking about it that way, at least for me anyway, kind of helps me in the humility department to revere the holy angels, because they're so much higher than we are, and yet God assigns them to take care of us. And last thing that comes to my mind, Lonnie, is that in the incarnation, think of what God did. He became a lower creature, lower than the angels in being a man, and the angels, the good angels, in their humility, they worship Jesus as God and man, even though as a man, he's lower than them. And that must really tick off the evil one and the demons, that they're conquered by an even lower creature in terms of the Lord's humanity. As God, he's not a creature, obviously. But in his incarnation, he becomes even lower than the angels. Think of how that must drive them crazy, knowing that they're conquered by a human being as opposed to one of their own peers. I find that endlessly fascinating.
It is. And we'll have an eternity to talk to them and discuss it all.
Indeed. Indeed we shall. Well,
thank you,
anything
Patrick.
More on this? Okay, good. Well, Lonnie, thank you for the excellent question.
Yes, thank you. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you. You too. Let's go to Jim now in Dayton. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a problem with going to confession. Well, let me tell you this. I am 70 years old. I was brought up Catholic when I was younger, got away from the church for quite a amount of years. And in 2021, I found Relevant Radio and started doing the rosary with Father Rocky. And
great.
And slowly back, and I joined a parish here in Dayton and everything. But confession, I always have a problem with. I try, of course, I stay away from mortal sins pretty much all the time. Okay. So when I go to confession, I do all the mind thinking and the commandments and all. But all the sins I come up with, you know, are thoughts that I immediately try to get rid of. And and how do you keep track of all that?
Yeah.
So you know, one time I went to confession. I kind of told the priestess, and he said, "Well, we all have our own little demons and to deal with." Well, thank you, but that wasn't a good answer for me.
Okay. So if I can rephrase what you just said, Jim, are you thinking about how do you deal with temptation in its various forms? Is that part of your question?
The thing is, before I go to confession, I want to say, okay, this is what I've done and this is what I failed to do. And, right. Sometimes I don't have anything solid to say.
Okay. So you're wondering about when you go to confession, should you go if you don't have a mortal sin to confess? Is that part of the question?
Right. Yeah, it's part of it. Although I'd like to go to confession and say, look, I really didn't do anything, but I just want to come.
No. Okay. So this is an important question. So the sacrament of confession is for everybody, you know, all Catholics, whether or not they are guilty of mortal sin. If you have mortal sin, and I know you know this, but for the sake of people listening, if you're in the state of mortal sin, yes, you absolutely must avail yourself of the sacrament so that you can receive Holy Communion, and even more importantly, so that if you keel over dead, you're not going to die in the state of mortal sin and go to hell.
Right.
But the sacrament is also, in a devotional sense, for everybody, even let's say that you're just living a really holy, virtuous life by God's grace, and you don't have any mortal sins, and you may have some venial sins, virtually everybody does, the sacrament is open to you as well. And it's a good thing for you to go for the sake of the grace and the strength that you receive, all of which comes from the sacrament. It's not just about getting out of mortal sin. So yes, let's say that from this point in your life to the end of your life, you never ever committed a mortal sin ever again. Well, keep going to confession because it strengthens your soul and it intensifies God's grace in your soul.
Right.
Does that answer your question? Is that what you were asking about?
What do I say to the priest?
Let's do it together. Okay, so bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 3 months, 1 month, whatever, since my last confession. I am married with children, and I'm not aware of being in the state of mortal sin since my last confession, but I am aware of sins including, and then you would go through whatever venial sins you might bring to light in your examination of conscience. And if you don't have like a specific venial sin, perhaps it's your persistent faults. Maybe you're impatient. Maybe you are, maybe your prayers are perfunctory and you just realize that you have an ongoing imperfection when it comes to trying at least to pray with some kind of fervor. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's your confession. And you talk about the things you're aware of. And what I do, you don't have to do this. Nobody has to do this, but I do this for my own benefit, is when I'm done with whatever I'm confessing, I say, and for these and all the sins of my past life, I'm truly sorry. And I can't even remember most of them, but I want to be sorry for them. And then I can leave everything there at the foot of the cross. So that would be an example, Jim, of even if you weren't really conscious of the venial sins, mm-hmm. you would confess what you are aware of. But I'll leave you with one final thought. I do have to take a break. As the great saints show us and teach us, the more mature you become in grace, in following Jesus, in virtue, etc., not only do mortal sins fall away to the point where you never, ever, ever fall into one. It doesn't mean you couldn't, but you just get to the point where you just never do. And it would be unthinkable to rebel against God because you love him so much. You've gotten to that point. That's one thing. And for the people who get to that point, for the rest of their lives, more often than not, they would never really need to confess a mortal sin. But there's another magnifying effect that takes place. As you grow in Christian virtue and you are more and more and more committed to being a follower of Jesus, your soul is more sensitive, your conscience is more sensitive, and you become aware of venial sins much more readily, so that you can, by God's grace, begin to root those out as well, faults, failings, negligence, venial sins, etc. So that's one of those effects of growth and holiness the great saints tell us, is that your magnifying lens becomes that much sharper and clearer, and you can spot those venial sins more readily. I'll leave it at that. But it's a very good question, Jim, and I hope that's helpful to you. I'll be right back with more right after this. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Let's go to Leticia in California. Hello, Leticia.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah,
I was calling because I've been listening to you for probably over 8 years.
Well, thank you.
And reading your stuff for forever. So thank you so much for everything you do. But I live in California, and I love California, but as everybody else is probably just really not in a state of despair, but just the way our country, I mean, our state has become so evil. So, I've been listening and making connections by some of the topics we've been having in the recent week or so about invoking the saints, about getting more intense in our prayer life.
Yeah.
And also just on Monday with the eclipse, all the talk about Nineveh. I don't know. I have this hope and this joy that California can turn around. And, you know, I'm not one of those that's probably going to leave. But I really think that we just need to kind of rise up. And it dawned on me that with the mission fathers here, and sorry, I was just running right now.
That's okay.
There's so much, everybody's name. I mean, there's so many, all of our cities, many of our cities are named after saints.
That's true.
You were talking about the archangels right now. So we have San Miguel, San Gabriel, San, you know, Rafael. We have Los Angeles is, you know, El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora, La Reina de Los Angeles, after our Blessed Mother. And even Sacramento, I mean, the Blessed Sacrament, right? So it's almost like this deposit of faith and prayer was left here by the fathers. And, you know, we have this sleeping giant, I believe. And I think all of us in California who believe, and outside of California, we just need to kind of call upon them and pray and, you know, have that minimal conversion, right? We, you know, we just need to rise up. And it's no doubt to me that I think that's why old Harry Legs is, you know, really going for California, because, you know, it's just the faith is so deeply ingrained in this state. So I'm just calling out to all of our, you know, brothers and sisters to rise up in prayer and have faith, and let's turn California around back to the Lord.
I like the sound of that. Nancy and I are California natives, born and raised there, and lived most of our lives there until we wound up leaving California. And when we left, it wasn't nearly as far gone as it has become now. But in any case, we love California just like you do. We have family and friends, many family and friends in California, and it's a wonderful, beautiful state. But it has become very corrupted by the political leadership. And I would say, and maybe this is really what you're aiming at here, Leticia, a lot of apathy among the people in California who, as long as there's, you know, as long as the house is cool in the summer and warm in the winter and there's beer in the mm-hmm. fridge and they have their internet connection, they just sort of go with the flow. Yeah. You talked about rising up. I mean, obviously, we're not, neither you nor I are talking about like an armed insurrection or anything like that. But to rise up in prayer and rise up in the voting booth and rise up at schools and rise up in, you know, in ways in which we can make our presence felt, certainly through prayer, if only even just a small percentage of the faithful in California would do that, I don't think things would be the way they are now. So I hope that your prayer is heard by God. I know there are many good, faithful Catholic folk and other folk, not just Catholics too, good, faithful people in California who want to do what's right, but you're very much outnumbered. And the majority is not the evil part of the people. It's the apathetic people. Right. They just don't care. They just would rather, you know, leave my internet connection alone and I will be just fine, mm-hmm. you know. And right. that's something we have to really work on, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I spent a lot of time over the last couple of years, you know, like I say, I was born in the late 60s, and so I mourn the fact that I didn't have that good catechesis, and thank you so much for all you guys do at Relevant Radio. We've been, we were turned on to you like back in the late 90s, and I still have your cassette tapes and your VHS. But
from the era of cassettes.
Yeah, yeah, but we're just kind of like, it's helped me to swim kind of against the current, right? So every day I'm just trying to, you know, like even you were saying prayer, all these different things, but even in our conversation with other people and in our little direct circle here, it's just kind of being uncomfortable, you know, bringing up these mm-hmm. topics. And hopefully, you know, that it'll spark, you know, something in the apathetic, you know.
Yeah.
You
know. It is person. I know what you're talking about. And it is person specific, though. Do you remember, you may be too young to remember, but there was this phenomenon among evangelical Protestants in the 90s where they had a thing called Promise Keepers. And it was typically mm-hmm. it was for men, and they would fill stadiums. They would fill Dodger Stadium. They'd fill Angel Stadium with tens and tens and tens of thousands of men who would go, and they would get all fired up, and they would pray, and they would, you know, in some cases, hoop and holler and all that good stuff. And then what happened? Nothing. It was like a wave crashing on the shore. It was good in the moment. That's great. I'm all in favor of the guys, you know, praying and wanting to do what was being promoted to them at these Promise Keepers. Now you never hear about it. It was a fad. I mean, not a bad fad. It was a good fad, but it was a fad.
Yeah.
And it came and went, and now it's over, and there's little, if anything, to show for it, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So what we need, I believe, is, you know, more of that stuff. Sure, that's fine. Doesn't seem to do a whole lot. But we need something that is lasting and that will endure going forward. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just a fad. And we've had fads, and they don't really do a whole lot, right?
Right, right. Exactly. So yeah. Well, thank you very much. And
you're welcome.
My mother and I will see you guys in Indianapolis. We're going this summer to the Eucharistic Convent.
Oh, so
we're
very excited. I look forward to that. I look forward to that. And be sure to come over and say hello. I'll be doing the program live when we're there in Indianapolis. I'm really looking forward to that. That's coming up in July. So yes, I look forward to seeing you and your mom, Leticia, and hopefully a big contingent from California will be there as well. Thank you. Let's go to Jan now in Wisconsin. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I would like to make a comment to that young lady, 16-year-old, that was asking about ectopic pregnancy.
Yes. Well, she didn't ask about an ectopic pregnancy. I raised that as an example. That wasn't on her radar screen, but yes, I know what you're talking about.
I'd like to make a comment on that. I went through that. And at the time, I had a Catholic doctor, and he came in the room, and he made the comment that, just a minute.
Tell you what, we're going to put Jan on hold. We'll come back to Jan when she's ready. Let's go to David in New Mexico. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For all you do.
It's just, you're welcome.
It's incredible. Long-time listener since when you were in Catholic Cancer Live in El Cajon, California, my birthplace. But we moved away like 42 years ago from California to New Mexico.
I hear you.
Anyways, the lady I called earlier about the lamb.
Yes.
One thing I remember really good was I listened to Mark Vervalli. Is it Mark Vervalli?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because I got some of those little reading cards, and I remember just as soon as she said that, it came to mind. Jesus is the ultimate shepherd, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And the way I see it, Mother Mary's like over the world, and the little lambs are just, you know, there. And we represent little lambs. And exactly how you mentioned it earlier, they're such a real soft animal, real quiet animal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wish
they're
people
meek.
Were like, literally, yes, you know, they're real respectful, real, they just obey.
They're docile,
and
yeah.
Exactly. And I just, mm-hmm. that's the first thing that came to mind. And I said, I got to call it. I can't let it get away. So.
Well, I'm glad you did,
Dave. Yeah, I just can't believe everything you say. It just, I mean, people don't understand. It's just so awesome, all the wisdom. I've been listening to you for quite a while, so, and I've learned so much. It's just, I can't get over it.
I'm so
thank you for all you do.
I really appreciate that, David. Relevant Radio is a powerful, tremendous tool that God has blessed us with. So I only have one question for you. Do you have a Relevant Radio bumper sticker on your car yet?
No, I don't.
Can we fix that? I'll tell you how to fix it. Okay, so just go to relevantradio.com. And under support, if you just mouse over that word, it'll give you a drop-down menu. And just click on order a bumper sticker. We'll actually send you two if you want them. And you have one for your motorcycle and one for your car, or one for your wife's car, one for your car. They're free. And you can evangelize while you're out and about.
Uh-huh. Yes. May I ask one question myself?
Please do.
Real quick. I was wondering, since as a little kid, you know, even being out there, why, I mean, you know, I grew up, you know, the faith was fairly strong, I believe. We prayed, you know, we asked for, you know, prayers to saints, the Lord, Mother Mary. With some, you know, when something's going wrong or something, and I'm sure you know what a manda is, right? That you ask and you'll promise to go to that church, like, say, for instance, in Mexico somewhere.
Sure.
And you go give
make
thanks.
A little pilgrimage.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm wondering why other, you know, the Protestants, and I never hardly ever hear of people doing that, or like
Protestants
big,
generally don't
miracle.
Do that. Yeah, Protestants generally don't do that. You might find a little bit of that among, let's say, the Anglo-Catholic or, you know, kind of high church of England groups of people, but you'll never find a Baptist doing that or Lutherans or anything. And here's why. Because the Catholic custom of going on a pilgrimage involves the physical reality of things. And this is why, for example, so many Protestants reject the sacraments generally. They might accept baptism, but that's about it. They're predisposed, I would say most of them, to look askance at the Catholic Church's insistence that God uses material things to convey grace. How can God give you grace through a little wafer, they say? Baptism doesn't really do anything. It's just an ordinance. It's just an outward sign. We do it out of obedience to Jesus, but it doesn't really do anything, Baptists will tell you. And that is a deeply rooted issue for many of them, and this is maybe even unconsciously part of their resistance or protest against the Catholic Church, because they're uncomfortable with the fact that God, number one, created matter as good. God said after he created all these things, this is good, this is good, this is good. Book of Genesis, or book of Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And when God finishes the creation, he says, this is very good. And the Catholic Church extols this reality that matter is not evil, matter is good. It can be used for evil purposes. And that God chooses to use matter, water, oil, wheat, wine, etc., to convey grace. So this is part of the bigger picture of, well, why would I want to go to a place Well, okay, Jesus, where he walked, sure, I'd like to go there. I'd like to read my Bible on the Mount of Olives. I'd like to walk among the hills and in areas where Jesus walked. I mean, sure, they'd say, yeah, but why would I go to, like, a church in a different town to make a pilgrimage? That, it doesn't make sense to them. It's not in their way of looking at things, but it's deeply ingrained in the Catholic way of looking at things.
Yes.
So that's, I think, part of why you never see that in the Protestant world. Mm, they just don't understand it. They don't look at things the same way when it comes to that sort of thing, which is odd when you think about it, because Protestants, Jews, atheists, Catholics, you name anybody, we all recognize the importance of, like, if you can go to a Civil War battlefield, that's cool. That's interesting. You don't have to be Catholic to like that. So I've often thought about this and thought, you know, what is it about making a pilgrimage that is uniquely Catholic and not so common at all in other religious groups? And I have a feeling it has to do with that. Anyway, I'm overdue for a break, but thank you for your very interesting question and your kind words, David. All of us here at Relevant Radio really appreciate that. I'll be right back with more right after this. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Love this song a lot, I'll tell you that. 888-914-9149. Here's a note from Sophia. It's actually the second time she sent me this note, so I want to make sure I answer it. I have a feeling she's anxious for an answer. She's asking about marriage and relationships. If a couple makes the mistake of being intimate before marriage, are they then obligated to get married to each other, or would breaking up be considered just as or almost as immoral as divorcing their partner? Consequently, if they were to break up, would they have to remain single for the rest of their lives as if they had gotten a divorce? I'll pause there because the rest of her email is on a somewhat different question. So if the couple, and we're talking here about neither one of them has ever been married to anyone else, and they obviously are not married to each other. If they fall into the sin of fornication, are they obligated to get married to each other? No, they are not. They've acted in this way as if they had been married or were married, but there's no obligation imposed for them to get married. Now, if they are seeking marriage and they love each other and they want to get married and they fell into this sin, as often happens, it's not an uncommon thing, then it shouldn't interfere with their desire to get married, but it should teach them, hopefully, an important lesson about how to be chaste in preparation for marriage. But they're not obligated to get married. Now, she says, would breaking up be considered just as or almost as immoral as divorcing? No, it would not, because if you break up, let's say that you realize, you know what, he took advantage of me, or he was using me, or he's an occasion of sin for me, or I don't really want to get married to him, then no, the thing you should do in a case like that is break up and move on, go to confession, etc., and then, you know, leave him in the dust, and that's the end of it. If he's a bad influence on your virtue. So no, there's no need to get married, and there's no sin or immorality involved because it's not a divorce. You're just moving away from somebody with whom you fell into sin. So she says, if they were to break up, would they have to remain single for the rest of their lives as if they had gotten a divorce? Absolutely not. If you fell into sin, he's not the right guy for you, you've cut off the relationship, and you're moving forward and you want to get married, you have every right to get married. And as I said, go to confession and get that cleared up and then learn a lesson from it. And when you find the right guy, or in the interim, in the meantime, while you're looking for the right guy, don't fall back into that sin. Okay, so here's the rest of her email. we have the sacrament of confession, and although there is freedom in God's forgiveness, I also know sins still have worldly consequences. I hear so much talk among Catholic and Protestant Christians about having to fix, quote-unquote, or solve, quote-unquote, the issue by getting married. And I've noticed a fairly prevalent theme among my peers, she says, feeling like they have to stay in unhealthy relationships because they already made that mistake. Is there any truth to this? Well, let's peel that back a little bit. Is there any truth to the idea that if you have a quote-unquote unhealthy relationship, that you have to stay in that relationship? No. No. If you're in an unhealthy boy-girl relationship, and by unhealthy, we're talking about sexually impure, unchaste, etc. No, far from it. Get out of that relationship. Now, if you discern, as I said a moment ago, this is the guy you want to marry, and you really do want to marry him, and he really does want to marry you, but you've been weak, well, then you stop being weak, and you use the Lord's grace to help you overcome this. Do things differently. Don't be alone together. Sometimes that's what's necessary. But no, you don't have to stay in that unhealthy relationship. And to fix it or to solve it, really, I think, is one or the other. The way to fix or solve a sexually unlawful relationship is to stop it, get out of it, get away from it. Or you can fix it or solve it by marrying the person if you truly believe this is the right one. And then, of course, this becomes lawful in marriage. Not every single last thing that could be done is lawful in marriage. I'm not saying that. But generally speaking, these things are lawful in marriage. So if that's what you mean by fixing it or solving it, that's the other way to do it. But by no means should you stay in a relationship that is detrimental to your spiritual life, to your soul. Don't do that. And then she signs off by saying, thanks so much. I've listened to your show since I was a teenager. And my dad would play Catholic radio in the car when he drove me to ballet class. Sophia, that makes me feel old, but I do appreciate the compliment. That's how long we've been doing this for a while. So thank you for that. And I hope that this answer is helpful to you. I know you sent me two emails, and I want to make sure that you feel like you got an answer to that. So thank you. Let's go to Jan now in Wisconsin. Hi, Jan. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. I'm sorry I put you.
It's okay.
I just wanted to make a comment on, I had a botanical pregnancy, and when the doctor came in the room.
Is that what you mean? An ectopic pregnancy?
No. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry you said it wrong.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood you because I wasn't familiar with that term, but go ahead, please. Yeah.
Okay. No. Anyway, the doctor came in the room and he explained what was going on, and I said, you can't do that. I'm Catholic. He says, I'm Catholic too, but he says, I will tell you right now, your baby's already gone because I was hemorrhaging. And he said that was too much stress on that, you know, because it was only like 2.5 months. Mm-hmm. He said, that's too much stress. But he said, if I don't go in and do a DNC, you will hemorrhage to death. Mm-hmm. And he says, I can get a priest over here right now to explain this to you because I didn't know what it was. And I said, will you promise me one thing? Will you make sure the baby's baptized? And he said, I will.
Well, so let's pause there. Let's pause. May we stop there and talk about that?
Sure.
Okay. So there are multi facets here. If the baby were already dead, as he said, as he told you, then no, the baby could not be baptized because there's no... I mean, the body of the baby is there, but the soul has gone on. So,
yeah, and I know different theologians and different priests, have got two poor different points of view. And I know this one priest that he said, we don't know exactly when the soul leaves the body.
Well, that's true. But there is no other right answer. The only right answer is if, in fact, death has taken place, then you can't baptize because the person is no longer there. So I want to be gentle here because I realize this is a very sensitive topic for you. All I'm saying is that if the doctor told you in no uncertain terms the baby has already died, then baptism, it can't happen. It wouldn't be valid. It wouldn't be real because there's no person there to baptize. Mm-hmm. If in fact there was a question, we don't know if the baby is still alive or not.
Right. Then right, I agree with that.
Right. So then that's where, if that's what the other person told you, that would be true. If there's a genuine uncertainty whether or not the baby has died, then yes, go ahead and baptize. Because if the baby hasn't died yet, then baptism takes place. But I just wanted to mention that because the doctor seemed, the way you said it, to be very emphatic. The baby's already gone. Baby's already dead.
Right. And he said he would get, he said, I could get, you know, our parish priest over and he would explain mm-hmm. it to you.
So, right.
So
you, when you heard me talking about the ectopic pregnancy example, did you know then what you now know, that for you to have that fallopian tube removed would not be sinful, even though the tube had within it this unborn, tiny little unborn human being? Did were you worrying at that time that would be sinful?
No. Well, okay. Back when I was having it done, yes, I was very concerned because I wasn't going to allow the doctor to do it. He said, you can't. Right. You have, you know, and he explained. And I, you know, I worked in the medical field too, and I do realize that, I under stress, that baby, that little, is what the doctor was saying. There was no chance of life. He couldn't survive mm-hmm. outside the womb. And because of his, you know, 2.5 months. So mm-hmm. I, when he said he's already, or she, I considered, I think he was a he. I believe that, that I agreed with the doctor that he couldn't have lived, you know.
Right.
And why am I saying he right now? Because I did name him. You know, because mm-hmm. I've gone through two of them, and I did name each child.
That's beautiful.
But I do, the doctor did make sense when she, you know, the survival rate would be zero.
Right. And that's true. I don't dispute any of that. And that's good that she explained it to you. I would offer this, though. The issue of the morality of having the diseased fallopian tube removed is not dependent upon whether or not the child could survive outside of the womb at that point, because obviously they can't at that stage, but rather the intention was not to kill the unborn child. The intention was to save you by removing this diseased part of your body. And the unintended negative consequence from that, emphasis on the word unintended, is that the baby would certainly die. Which right. is what they were explaining to you. But right. the morality or immorality of this act doesn't depend upon whether or not the baby is viable. It has to do with your intention, and the intention was good. There was no intention, in other words, to end the life of that baby. Go ahead, Jan.
Oh, no, I felt at peace when the doctor explained it. But I also want to make a comment. I've gone through 2 miscarriages, and I believe they were babies. I saw the little baby in the doctor's hand, and at 2.5 months, it was completely formed.
Yeah, and that was a baby.
You know, and the miracle of life is that was a child, not a blob of tissue.
Exactly.
And you know, we go through the grief of losing that, you know, there, when I woke up, it was like somebody had taken something sacred out of me. Mm-hmm. And I did bereavement work for our church for years. And I went to training, and they said about, you know, around the room, they ask, you know, they were telling about naming the child, you know, doing. Mm-hmm. And in that process, I started tears start coming down my face, and I looked around the room, and I saw several women in tears. And so when you think we don't grieve a loss of a child, and yet we had no choice, and the people that make that choice, I'm sure they're grieving the same way that we had to go through it. because there's something so empty in your womb that you can't explain it. And because when you have a baby, they put them in your arms and you hold them. But this, when you lose a child, you don't have that.
Right.
So there's an empty, there's a void in you. So these women that are choosing to abort their children, they are going through that grief too. They're going through a pain of loss. And I don't understand how women can do it over and over, but I'm not there to judge, just to pray that their eyes are opened up. And that's, thank you for the time.
You're welcome, Jan. I hope that helped a little bit with the healing process too. And the women who heard it, no doubt, were helped by that as well. Thank you. I have a whole other hour with you straight after this timeout, so please stay right there. And if you want to call, call now. We've got a line or two open, 888-914-9149.